Hello? Hello? All right. Yep. Looks like we're in.
Good.
Okay. Sorry about the delay. So we've got a good crowd here, and let me first say thank you to Professor Chris Menzel for talking to us this morning. Someone just joined.
This is Garrett Minakawa.
Oh, hi, Garrett.
Hi.
Welcome. We're just about to start, so you came at the exact right moment. Okay, so let's go down the list, and I've already posted Professor Menzel's bio, and I would not go into the full detail, but it's an honor to have him talking to us, and I'm Peter Yim, co-convener of Ontolog, along with Kurt Conrad and Leo, and I welcome everyone. And let's go down the list as it appears on the wiki page now, and if everyone can give a brief intro to himself or herself, that would be great. Kurt?
Sorry, I had you guys on mute. My name's Kurt Conrad. I'm an independent consultant here in the Bay Area. I specialize in the area of information policy management and kind of organizational knowledge, flow design, that type of stuff. Probably enough.
Oh. Thank you. Bo?
This is Bo Newman, the founder of the KM Forum, currently senior analyst with TechEye2. Specialty areas are ontologies, knowledge flows, dynamics, semantics, that type of thing.
Great.
I'm Susan Turnbull from General Services Administration. I hold a leadership position in the Architecture and Infrastructure Committee, and I'm currently leading their Semantic Interoperability Study Group.
Welcome, Susan.
Mm-hmm. Who are you with?
General Services Administration, federal agency.
Oh, okay.
U.S. federal GSA. Peter.
I'm Peter Denno from NIST, and I work on various projects in system integration.
Monica?
Monica Martin, Sun Microsystems. Actually, I'm in the process area.
Great. Adam?
Adam Pease at Articulate Software, a one-man company working on formal ontology and reasoning in first-order logic.
Right. Actually, I was expecting Adam
Chire. Adam. Yeah, that's okay. Adam Chire. I'm at SRI International. I'm leading technology integration for the KALO project, which is about 300 engineers working to create a smart cognitive assistant that learns and organizes your life.
Fantastic. We have a lot of things to organize in our lives. Okay, if everybody refreshes their pages, the wiki page, actually, I've added a few names. So right next to Adam, we've got Jack Park. Jack?
Cool. I'm Jack Park, and I work with Adam on the KALO and the IRIS project, which is a desktop application, serves as a front side to IRIS, but will also serve as a personal productivity suite, including mail, calendars, and so forth.
And for those who may not aware, Jack co-authored the Topic Maps book with Sam Hunting. Yes, Michael?
Mike Ushold. I work for the Boeing Company in a research division mainly concerned with developing and applying ontologies and other knowledge representation and semantics technologies.
Great. Welcome. Sir?
Hi, this is Thurm from NIST. I'm working here at NIST on the US project, focused particularly on the content level model testing, including the schema level testing and the content implementation and schema implementation testing.
Great. We had Adam Pease already. Pat?
Hi, Pat Cassidy. I just joined at MITRE, and I'm working on ontologies generally. Recently, I've been mostly concerned with standardization of upper ontologies. I'll be getting into more specific types of ontology development here.
Thanks, Pat. Garrett?
Garrett Minakawa, Oracle Corporation, working in the Applications Division, focusing on integration of applications, and also fairly involved in the standards community for business messages, and come to this forum as a domain expert in the area of core components.
Fantastic. I heard a couple of ring-ins. Who else is with us?
David Jones from the Boeing Company, Phantom Works, and I work with ontologies and databases.
Welcome, David Jones. Are you a member of Ontolock or?
No, I work with Mike Ushold.
Oh, well, we would look forward to your joining us. Yes. Who else?
Bob Smith, a retired professor, interested in business process, linkages to knowledge management, and the fundamentals of ontology and ontology management.
Fantastic. Anyone else online? Okay, what a crowd. Fantastic. Welcome, everyone. I guess everyone is familiar with the logistics. If not, please raise the questions now. For those who can get shared screen access into the VNC session, the link is towards the top, and the view-only password is ontolock. For those who have trouble getting into the VNC session, generally because of corporate firewalls or things, then towards the bottom of the page there's another link that will allow you to download the PowerPoint to your local machine and run it from there. We will request Professor Menzel to tell us every time he advances the slides so that we are all in sync. There is also a section towards the bottom of the page that says if you have questions for the presenter, you can post them there. Of course, the wiki only allows one person to be writing at a time, so if you go into conflict, then just wait for each other. And in the during the talk, I mean, people can be posting questions, and at the end of the presentation, there will be a casual, informal discussion, and Chris could also field the questions that might be posted during that time. So without much ado, over to you, Chris.
Thanks, Peter. I'm very glad to be here. I'm impressed with how well organized the whole business is, and the idea of using VNC very effectively and creatively here is a nice wonder to behold. So on the first page there, we can see who I am and where I am. I am in the philosophy department. My area of research in philosophy tends toward the formal side with logical systems and certain philosophical issues that arise in logic, and I'm interested in a lot of pure issues in philosophy, kind of classical philosophical issues, mostly having to do with ontology and the relation to logic and language and such, and those sort of sacred interests got me interested in the more profane interests. When I first got out here over 15 years ago, I hooked up with a fellow in applied context, and that, of course, that was very exciting to me because as much as I enjoy doing the research I do, there's, you know, only a few hundred people in the world that have a lot, you know, have much interest in the sort of in similar sorts of things, and so the impact, practical impact, is fairly minimal. So it was exciting to work on issues that had a much wider, much broader impact in the real world, but which still had a lot of theoretical interest. So that's what got me into these into this world that sort of overlaps the formal interests and philosophical interests and very practical interests of real world systems. My first interests had to do with sort of formal models of processes, and that got me involved in the eventually in the PSL project out at NIST that Peter Denno has a bit to do with, and Michael Berninger. And Mike Witchfield has had, in the past, I guess, Mike has had connections with that as well. And also interested just in the use of logic and logical languages as a basis for expressing information, because first-order logic in particular seems to be sort of the right representational medium for expressing most any information you'd want to express. And there's some issues there. When I say that, that raises a lot of eyebrows sometimes, and there's issues about higher-order logics and such, and those are things perhaps we can get into. But it is the case historically in knowledge engineering and artificial intelligence that some form of first order logic and first order languages have been used to represent information, and the development of KIF, the knowledge interchange format, sort of helped to provide a general framework for typing logic in at a computer keyboard that quite a few people have adopted over the years. And however, there was a bit of a problem in that different people were using different forms and different versions of KIF, and the whole issue of standardization sort of arose, and that's sort of where a lot of this work in SCL came from. So let me go through the slides. That'll probably tell the story a little bit better here. That's just kind of a basic picture of how I myself ended up, despite being in a philosophy department, involved in these more practical issues. Okay, so I'm going to move to the first page, first real page.
Just a process question. Do you want people to stop you?
Yes, please.
At the presentation.
Yes, yeah. If I say things that are unclear, well, let's see. When I say something that's particularly unclear, just stop me and ask. I'd rather do it that way, because otherwise, you know, we'll lose the thread, and you might forget your question, or it might not be appropriate to bring it up again, and I don't want that to happen. I want to be able to address the questions, and the presentation's fairly short, and I do want it to be very informal, and think of the slides as really a medium for sparking discussion as much as anything. If we get all the way through, or don't get all the way through, that's fine. We'll certainly get far enough. Okay, so I'd mentioned the knowledge interchange format that originally came out of Stanford University, and here's where the initial motivation. So the situation was that we had this proliferation of different intelligence systems, and they were all sort of homegrown, and their own representation languages sort of grew organically up with them. So these are just simple examples here, or for well-known examples, some newer than others, classic, Dolce, SNEPS, KL1. And if you know these systems at all, you'd know that each of them, there'll certainly be similarities, but all of the languages underlying these systems are quite different, the representation languages that they use to actually express information in the system. So as, you know, with the growth of the Internet and the growth of computer systems and networking and such, obviously it became, and the adoption of some of these systems in more practical contexts, it became very important to be able to share and integrate information across these different frameworks. I mean, if you and I have different compatible businesses and we see an opportunity out there to build on to merge our product line in some way, or to develop a new product that uses each of our products, we want to be able to exchange business processes, for example. To be able to jointly manufacture something, say. Obviously, then, Homeland Security is an obvious sort of issue where different knowledge bases might need to be merged to be able to facilitate integration, sharing, to more effectively make use of that information. So the nice little picture there sort of illustrates that need. every framework potentially in a given cluster might need to share information with every other one. So I'm going to move to the next slide. So initial motivations again still. So here's the problem, or at least one problem. So a general solution to this difficulty or to this problem requires n squared minus n translators. And so the if you're thinking of bidirectional translators from each framework to the other, you need n squared minus n. And so the number of translators that means is going to grow exponentially with each new framework. So we see the addition there now of PsycL, which is another sort of logic-based framework with its own definitely quirky features and unique features. And we see the number of connections then has grown exponentially with just the addition of that one framework. So the arrows here, of course, are supposed to represent sort of conduits, translators between the different frameworks. Okay, any questions about this slide? Okay, I'm going to move to the next one. So this vision in KIF, the next initial motivation slide here, the solution that arose was a knowledge interchange format. The idea was to have a single hub, thinking of it as sort of a wheel metaphor, a kind of universal interlingua that each framework can speak. Does that person want to say who they are?
Yeah, hi, this is Carl Mattox.
Good, howdy.
Hi, Carl.
Hi, Peter. Okay,
we are on the slide that starts with KIF initial motivations.
Okay. There's several of those, actually, so you'll want to look on the next line, which says the solution, colon, KIF. That's the slide we're actually on.
Okay.
Okay, so, right, the idea that was, one of the ideas anyway, sparking KIF, was that if we had a single sort of interlingua, kind of a knowledge engineering Esperanto that everyone speaks, then you can move information around first by translating into this interlingua and then translating out to whatever framework you want, and that lowers the complexity of the growth of translators there, the number of translators you need to something linear. You just add a new framework, all you need are two new translators between the new framework and KIF and vice versa. Okay, any questions about this slide? Okay, move on. Okay, so DPANS KIF, the revised standard version. So the original KIF was a bit of a behemoth. It had some problems, none probably insurmountable, but there was in particular, it was a very, very free and open language. It also had some constructs known as sequence variables, which roughly speaking, a sequence variable, instead of taking like an ordinary variable, and I'm assuming some knowledge of first order logic here, and if you're not, don't work in first order logic that much, this is not an essential point, but in ordinary first-order logic, variables take single individuals in the domain as values. Sequence variables, not surprisingly, take finite sequences of things as values. Well, if you know a little first-order model theory, you'd know that when you add a word like finite, you're sort of asking for trouble, and indeed that does cause a number of problems for the formalization of KIF that were actually never really addressed. So there was never an actual semantics given for KIF that covered all the different aspects of the language. It was also not particularly well defined. It was kind of defined, but it really had some gaps in its definition, so it wasn't quite nailed down well enough. And out of that arose an effort to standardize KIF. In the meanwhile, despite its problems, KIF was a very nice way to write logic at a computer keyboard. Didn't involve any of those upside-down A's or backwards E's or anything of the sort. You could just type it in with a sort of lispy syntax in with lots of parentheses in at the keyboard, and it became quite popular as a nice way to write logic for computers. So there became a need, both because it was becoming quite popular, and also because of these problems in its presentation, its formal problems, to move to some sort of a standard which would nail down the syntax very clearly and the semantics. And that's what DPEN's KIF was intended to be, an ANSI standard that sort of gave a nice clean definition of KIF. So the idea was for a standardized framework for expressing declarative information, just first order. It's just a first order logic, basically, used a common syntax, a syntax that was kind of lispish looking, but it was by this time fairly widely used and well understood syntax. It used a common well understood semantics, because it was basically just first order first order logic in the basic version. Sequence variables, in particular, didn't occur in the sort of cut down first order version of it, and it had, in particular, the sort of constructs that we would need to enable semantic integration. It had some things involving quotation and so on, which are going to be necessary, metalinguistic notions that are going to be necessary for being able to say, okay, well, this ontology is expressing this piece of information, and this ontology over here is expressing that piece of information, and so we can sort of talk about the information in the different ontologies, and that can be used as going to be a very important sort of facility that we're going to need to be able to integrate ontologies. We have to be able to sort of objectify ontologies themselves and objectify the information that they contain so that we can then compare them. And then you can think of there being there are some additional constructs that KIF had as well that in certain contexts could prove to be very useful. In particular, this idea of variable polyadicity. What does that mean? That means nothing more than that in standard first-order logic, predicates like loves come with a built-in number of argument places, right? Like John loves Mary, you know, Bill loves Hillary. There's two in the usual languages. Loves is a two-place predicate. Always has two individuals. Well, there are certain contexts where that is not so convenient or desirable. There are a lot of predicates, especially ones that involve action of a certain kind, that can take sort of arbitrary numbers of arguments when you start adding things like locative information. So eats is a common example. So you can say John eats. You can say John eats the apple. John eats the apple in the kitchen. John eats the apple in the kitchen with some peanut butter. John eats the apple in the kitchen with some peanut butter at noon, and so on and so forth. It looks like the notion of eats, the eats predicate, seems not to have a fixed adicity. And the only way to handle that sort of case in a standard first-order language where all the predicates are fixed is you have to introduce one-place, two-place, three-place, four-place versions of the one eats predicate. So that one piece of natural language has to get represented with however many different n-place, fixed n-place predicates you need to be able to add all of that information. There's also a higher order syntax in KIF. It's not really a higher order logic, and if you don't know what that means, it doesn't matter. But the point is that there are a lot of knowledge engineering or knowledge representation contexts where it turns out to be useful if we think of predicates as referring to classes, especially one place predicates referring to classes, where you want to objectify the reference of those predicates themselves. So when you wanted to say, human is a subclass of animal, right, you're making an assertion about the classes that are indicated by the predicates themselves. And you might want to, if you indicate having a predicate in the usual first-order way, as just simply, prefixing the predicate to an object, so we say that Rover is a dog, just by writing dog Rover is the usual way it happens in first order logic. Well, you might in certain cases you might want to indicate that a certain predicate you want to ascribe a property to a predicate itself. So you might want to again say dog is a subclass of mammal, and now we have what was a predicate, dog, is now itself a subject of a predication, where we're saying dog is a subclass of mammal. The sort of simplest and easiest way to be able to represent this is just to be able to take our predicates and, in certain contexts at least, allow them themselves to be subjects of predication. And I believe, for example, in the sumo ontology, there are numerous instances of this sort of thing. Isn't that right, Adam?
Well, we use a little bit different syntax. I think that's true in general. Although, of course, we use the instance and subclass.
Oh, that's right. But of course, there's no that turns out to be really just a notational choice that you can make whether or not to use those predicates. So there are, as Adam notes, there are going to be other ways of representing this besides allowing. I take that back. So Adam, you are saying you do use the subclass of predicate, right?
That's right.
And instance of. So those are cases. So actually, I'm saying you're actually making my point. So those are cases where you're actually going to have. I see what you're saying. Okay, right. Yeah, okay, I gotcha. So what you're saying is that you wouldn't even use something like dog in predicative position. You would always use something like instance of. Is that correct?
That's right. So sumo has no confusion between names and class names.
Okay, gotcha. Well, I would balk at the idea of confusion there. As long as it's handled decently, all things are done decently and in order, it can be done. It turns out to be actually a very elegant way to do things as well. But
right, that was a sloppy adjective on my part.
Okay, good. Well, but you're also, the point is well taken, because it is certainly the case that many knowledge representation languages have not been at all clear about the distinction between terms and predicates and how it is that they can use predicates in one context or terms in one context as predicates and in other contexts as subjects of predication. It does definitely have to be done in a non-sloppy, decent, orderly way. Type freedom. Jumping ahead a little bit. The points I was just making there were really all points about type freedom. The higher order syntax, a very related notion, it allows you actually then to have quantifiers over predicates as well. So you can express things like the relation of symmetry or the property of symmetry for relations. You'd want to generally quantify over relations in general, right, to express that what it is for a relation to be symmetric. You say, for any R, if any two-place relation R, if R X Y, then R Y X, right? If X bears R to Y, then Y bears R to X. And there R is a free variable, so it seems like you should be able to quantify as well. And then finally, the sequence variables are still there as sort of an additional construct. Are they there in DPANS KIF, Adam? Do you remember? I'm actually getting fuzzy on this now.
I'm afraid I can't speak with authority.
I think actually they are there. They are there. Yeah. There's DPANS KIF, and then there's this sort of more orderly version or more somewhat cut down version that you use and that's being used in the sumo, which
right.
is a bit weaker than the DPANS KIF. So you have some order being brought. The point of this long slide here is you've got some order being brought to what had been a rather disorderly KIF. You've got a very clear expression of its syntax, a good account of its semantics, though still some things missing, actually, turns out. And you've got at least the power of first-order logic, plus these nice additional powerful constructs like variable polydicity, polydicity type freedom, higher-order issues, and, if you want them, sequence variables. Okay, moving to the next slide. Depends KIF the problems. And I've tried to list sort of three problems here that still plague the depends version. So first is the uniformity problem. So it's what you can't get away from is that when you if you give this definition of KIF, you're defining yet another representation language. So one that has a very fixed, you know, with one that has a fixed syntax and fixed features. I mean, you simply have to do that if you want to express a language clearly and correctly. But then what you're saying essentially is, well, look, you know, anybody who wants to use KIF, you know, has to use this, you know, has to use this particular framework. If you want to write logic, you know, with a KIF-like language, you've got to, here's the framework you get, and you've got to do things this way. And, you know, for some contexts, for some purposes, that's a good thing. But in general, what happens is, you know, people get very attached to their knowledge representation languages. And, you know, if you've been using a certain language, it's difficult to move to use something else. Even if it's just for purposes of integration, it may be difficult to see exactly how things are supposed to work, right? You have to learn this entirely new language and do things their way, even if it's only to write translators into it, if you're using it as an interlingua. Let me emphasize that point, too, is that KIF, even though its original sort of vision was as an interlingua, as according to the pictures earlier on, it did start to become used very broadly as itself a knowledge representation language for expressing information. The sumo is a good example of that. Okay, so that's the uniformity problem. Then what I call the excess baggage problem. So I mentioned on the previous page all those additional constructs, which, you know, you can certainly give arguments for having them at your disposal. But when you sort of standardize something, what you're saying is, well, look, you know, you get the whole package. And a lot of those constructs, you know, the higher order syntax, the variable polyadicity, those are things people aren't generally or often going to want. Variable polyadicity, I mean, a lot of people want, they like the orderliness of each predicate having a certain number of arguments. And we know at the outset, when you specify the signature of a language, you want to say, okay, here's my loves predicate, and it takes two arguments. They may not want they may perceive this variable polydicity as sort of disorderly and difficult to manage, and it well could be in certain contexts. So it seems onerous to require these additional constructs for conformance to a standard that could be useful for a number of purposes, and where those constructs are not really needed. Finally, the formalization problem. So the problem that I mentioned with the original KIF actually does persist with depends KIF, in particular with regard to sequence variables. They wanted to keep those sequence variables there, and they really never provided any model theory for them at all. The model theory, if you go to the old KIF website, you'll find a model theory paper there. If you take a look at it, it's really doing nothing but providing a model theory for a much weaker fragment, the kind of standard first order fragment. So there's not it hasn't got a complete model theory. What it does give a model theory for is standard and well understood, but they provide more in the language than they actually give us in the model theory, in the semantics. Finally, there's no real proof theory for it. They don't provide us with a logic for KIF, and KIF depends. KIF still has got a lot of constructs that are non-standard, and hence you can't just look to a standard sort of axiomatization of first-order logic as its proof theory. So it's missing a proof theory as well. And then, of course, since there's not enough model theory, you, of course, can't, even if they had some sort of proof theory, you wouldn't be able to prove some of the usual kinds of model theoretic or meta-theoretic results that you'd want to prove, like a completeness theorem. All right, so I'm moving to the next slide, an approach to a solution, emphasis on approach, simplified common logic. So this project arose out of the desire to move forward the Depend-KIF effort, and it involved Adam Pease and myself and John Soa, Pat Hayes, Michael Grininger, Mike Genesareth here and there, Chris Welty, now of IBM. Who am I obviously leaving out, Adam? Anybody?
There may have been a lot of other people that are involved in the several years since I actually dropped out.
Yeah. Well, I'm just trying to remember back to when the days when it first when we first started moving in this direction away from KIF towards SCL.
Yeah, you mentioned everybody I remember.
Okay. Did I mention Michael Ushul, didn't I, Mike?
Earlier you did.
Yes, yeah. Okay. Well, Mike Ushul was also also a part of this as well. So. SCL arose out of this, the desire to continue the standardization effort for KIF. But we started to realize quickly that you know, look, we you know, some of the problems that we just had noticed on the previous page, it seemed sort of heavy-handed to have this language which is designed to facilitate integration and that people are now also using for an actual knowledge representation language to sort of require it to take this one certain form. Furthermore, right, it says, well, what we're standardizing, you got to do things this way if you want to write logic. I mean, the idea was to have a framework for writing logic. But, you know, why force people to write it one particular way? I mean, you know, KIF uses all these parentheses, sort of uses the particular, the particular names for the Boolean operators and the quantifiers. What if you don't use those names? What if you're just not used to using this particular syntax, but you've got a perfectly good framework for writing logic? We're thinking of maybe John Soa's CGIF, right? The linear form of his conceptual graphs, perfectly good way of writing logic at a keyboard, for example, right? And now, semantic web type languages too. There might be convenient to have a logical language that has a kind of RDF-ish sort of syntax. RDF itself is a kind of logical language. So, if part of the idea was to standardize a framework for writing logic, it seems not only authoritarian, but given the way that these languages sort of get entrenched as people use them, it seems sort of like it was not going to be a project that would succeed. I mean, it's very difficult to turn people away from frameworks that they're used to using. So the idea was, well, look, why do we call all of the, whenever people are writing logic in some framework or other, what makes it count as writing logic? I mean, in some sense, they're doing the same thing, even though they're using different frameworks. So the idea that became pretty apparent here is that what you could standardize on is structure rather than particular form. If people are writing a conjunction, P and Q, it shouldn't matter whether they're using, you know, a wedge or the word and or some other form to represent conjunction. It's the same concept, right? Or if you use, you know, open and closed tags like in a tag language like RDF, and you use the word, you know, conjunction and then write some stuff and then slash conjunction, that should still count as a conjunction. So when people are writing logic, what makes it the case that in every case they're actually writing logic is that they're adhering to a certain, their languages, their frameworks are adhering to a certain structure rather than to a rather than to the fact that they're using just that particular framework. So the idea, once again, then, is to try and standardize that structure rather than requiring any particular form. So that was the way that this uniformity problem was going to be addressed, we thought should be addressed. The excess baggage problem, the idea would be now to allow, to establish a framework where the additional constructs are allowed rather than imposed. So, yes, it is the case that variable polyadicity or the higher order syntax or the type freedom can all be very useful. But there are many contexts where it wouldn't be, where, in fact, you want to impose more structure on the language. And in those cases, you don't want to be having to remain conformant with a standard. You don't want to have to give up those, in those cases, you don't want to have to be able to, you don't want to have to remain conformant, you don't want to have to give up those features that you'd like to be able to add, those additional constraints you'd like to be able to add. So the idea with that problem, again, is to allow rather than impose additional constructs. If people want to be able to use them, if type freedom or variable polyadicity, like the EATS predicate, if that turns out to be convenient, allow people to use frameworks in which predicates are polyadic, variably polyadic, but don't require it. So the question is going to be, of course, how to do this. And then finally, formalization. Clearly, you need to have a rigorous model theory that covers all aspects of the language. Depends. KIF was missing a complete model theory, complete in the sense that it provided some semantics for all the different linguistic constructs available in the language. You'd like there to be a complete proof theory, just a set of axioms that can be used for reasoning. And okay, that's really that's just noting that in fact there is there's even a proof theory for the sequence variable. You can't even add the sequence variables as one of the additional constructs in SCL, and we do have, unlike Depends KIF, there is in fact a rigorous model theory and a proof theory for those sequence variables. But the main two points, the first two bullet points there under formalization, are sort of the main ones to stress in this context. Okay. So next slide. All right. So this will be a bit of a discussion, a very very quick overview of how how these ideas are implemented, and it's the idea that I want to get across, not the particularities. We want to just get a sense of how we were able, or how we approached this idea of standardizing structure, for example. So note, when you define a standard first-order language, you start out by our standard, representation language, may not be full first-order. So you start out by saying, okay, here are the basic elements that you can use in your language. So you think of like a language like RDF or HTML. Not that that's a representation language, but you'll say, okay, here are the things you can form. You take angle brackets and you can put a string in between angle brackets, and you can have the same string with a slash in front of it between angle brackets. And here are the keywords, and you give the particular keywords for the language. And a logical language, those are going to be things like, conjunction or disjunction of some sort, like a wedge or a caret or the word and the word or. So you'll actually say very explicitly what the elements of the language are going to be. Because the idea in SEL is to just simply say what a lexicon has to include without at all specifying what the shapes of those elements are going to be. So notice we say there, an SEL lexicon shall include a class of non-logical symbols. So some things called predicate constants, a distinguished element id. Now that's a meta-theoretic term, id. You can use the identity symbol, you can use, equal to, you can use whatever you want, but we're just simply, in the meta language, we're just giving a name to whatever it is that this thing has to be that represents identity in your language. You have to have a class of individual constants. What are they? Doesn't matter, right? It's up to you to specify. and a class of function symbols. This could be non-empty. And again, no specification. Two types of variables, what we call general variables and what we call sequence variables. And again, that's possibly empty. You don't. So here's where we can see one point where this idea of permitting rather than requiring, right, certain additional constructs in the language. So notice the sequence variables can be possibly empty. So if you don't want them, you don't have to have them, and you'll still be conformant with the standard. And then an arity function. Now notice this is for taking care of the idea of a variable for allowing for variable polyadicity, but not requiring it. So notice you can impose an arity, an adicity, right, a fixed number of places that have to be that each predicate can take. You can require of each predicate, there we say P is an n-place predicate if the arity of P equals n. So you can have this arity function assign a number n, which is supposed to be its arity, to each predicate. And otherwise, it's variably polyadic if it doesn't assign a particular number n to it. So notice there you can alter these parameters however you want. You can impose, you can assign an arity to every single predicate of your language or to none. So again, this is enabling languages that want to be completely variably polyadic at one end, and languages that have no variable that can be completely variably polyadic at one end, at one extreme, and at the other extreme, every predicate can have a fixed arity. Yes?
This is Adam. Just a question or maybe sort of a comment. So one thing that I did in SuoKIF was to actually leave the definition of arity out of the language and put that into the ontology. So I think that's mirroring what you're saying, that
exactly.
A particular language could be sort of uncommitted, and then I've just made the choice to put that in the ontology.
Yeah, and that could be a way you could do this. I mean, in a sense, what SCL is, you can think of sort of SCL as giving you an ontology of a class of languages, really. And in a sense, you just sort of you did the same sort of thing at the ontology level, right? So notice this does permit, again, but does not require the variable polyadicity. If you want a standard first order language, so notice so far, standard first order language, what we'll have here is the sequence variables set will be empty. Right, you'll just have standard variables. I call them general variables for reasons that I'll discuss in a minute. And the arity function would assign a fixed definite arity to every predicate of the language, and similarly for each n-place function symbol. What turns out to be the case is that standard familiar sorts of first-order languages just simply occupy one end of a spectrum of languages that are included in the class of languages that turn out to be SCL conformant. So again, we're not defining a particular language, which is what DPAN's KIF was doing. We're defining, we're providing a general definition of the structure that an entire class of languages satisfies. Okay, I'm going to move to the next slide. Features of SCL lexicon. So really, the type freedom permitted but not required, I've just made that point. That's where the arity function is just simply not. I lied. That's not right. That's the variable polyadicity allowed. Type freedom permitted. Okay, so here's another point. So I'm going to move back a page. So we see there an SCL lexicon shall include predicate constants, individual constants. Now, in a standard first-order language, those two sets of constants will be disjoint. No predicate constant is an individual constant, and vice versa. Well, I guess we don't need to say that, do we? So moving to the next page now, notice I did not put a constraint saying that those classes need to be disjoint. In standard first-order languages, they are, but we don't require it in SCL. So in those cases where there's overlap between the predicate constants and the individual constants, you have predicate markets, which can simultaneously be individual constants and hence can occur both in predicate position or in subject position in an atomic sentence. That is to say, more semantically speaking, they can be both predicated of things. There can be both predicables, like loves, or dog is predicated of, you know, individual dogs, but they can also be subjects of predication themselves, as when we want to say dogs are mammals. Okay, and then, as I said, variable polydicity, again, is allowed, but not required. And then points in the lexical spectrum, as we say here. So we can have completely unconstrained lexicons where there's no distinction whatsoever between predicate constants and individual constants. It's just the same class. So every constant can occur either as in predicable position, in predicative position, where it's something that you predicate of other things, and it can occur in subject position. That's actually classic KIF. Classic KIF, the original KIF, actually made no distinction between individual constants and predicate constants. It just had a set of constants, and you could use them arbitrarily. And this turns out to be actually very nice for a lot of knowledge representation contexts where you just sort of don't want to worry about exactly what the nature of certain things are, right? I mean, you can just simply predicate things of them, and if necessary, predicate them of other things. The arity function is the empty set in this completely unconstrained language, which is to say that no predicates are assigned a fixed arity. Every predicate can take any finite number of arguments, and where all the predicates are just the same thing. That's complete type freedom, right? Complete type freedom. And then at the other end, that's one end of the lexical spectrum. At the other end of the lexical spectrum is a traditional first-order language, where the arity function is a total function, that is to say every predicate is assigned an arity, and the sets of predicates, constants, and function symbols are all completely pairwise disjoint. No predicate is an individual constant, no predicate is a function symbol, and so on. Okay, I'm going to move to the next page unless there's questions. All right, SCL grammar. Now here's where we're expressing just simply the general structural constraint on an SCL language. It's just a general structural constraint. It's not one that imposes any particular, you know, any specific concrete shape and form to the terms of a language. Now, by a term, we mean typically an expression that is a denoting expression. It refers to something. So this is usually things like names, like John, the name John, but also function terms like the father of. In natural language, that would be an example of a function term, right? The father of blank, right? And you apply that to a given object, like John, the father of John, and you get another object, which is John's father. Okay, so all that we require then is that basically what this is saying is that if you've got it just in very general terms, what the piece of set theoretic sort of apparatus there is saying is simply that if you've got an n-place function symbol, your arity function has yielded for you an n-place function symbol, and n terms, then your term-forming operator, however it works, yields another term as its output. Similarly, what the union sign there is indicating is that this is an operator which takes both n-place function symbols and then variably polyadic function symbols as well. So you take a function symbol, an n-place function symbol, and n terms, you have to have a term-forming operator in your language that yields then a new term out of those elements. If you've got a variably polyadic function symbol and any number of terms, again, your term-forming operator has got to form a term out of those. How? In what way? It's completely up to you. It's absolutely unspecified. It's only the structure that matters. This is how you form terms. And anybody who's writing logic has to form terms in structurally in this way, but the specific manifestation of your language, how terms look in your language, completely doesn't matter. So look here under concrete manifestations. We have three bullet points here, and we see three different possible manifestations of the the results of a particular term-forming operator for different languages. The first two, of course, look quite similar. The top one is a kif-like representation, where we've got plenty of outside parens. The second one is a fairly standard-looking kind of first-order logic representation, where a function argument notation, where you've got the function and then its arguments inside of to its right, inside parentheses, separated by a comma there. The last one, of course, is an RDF-ish looking, semantic web-ish looking expression. Very, very different from the others. But notice, all three exactly, are three different concrete manifestations of that general structure specified in the grammar for terms. Right, we've got a function symbol, and we have some appropriate number of terms, and of course, the only constraint is that these definitions have to be well formed in a way that they can be given a good semantics. But if they adhere to the structure in question, you'll be able to do that. Okay, any questions about this page?
Chris, shouldn't it be sentence rather than term in the outside operator? I mean, you haven't defined what term means, of course, in this particular syntax, but it just seems it would be a little clearer that way.
No, because I'm forming terms here now, Adam. I'm not forming sentences yet.
Oh, so hdiff is a function.
Yes, hdiff is supposed to yield a number.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, so yeah, I that's a good point, though. I should perhaps say that's not obvious what hdiff is supposed to mean. So right, hdiff is a function that takes two objects as arguments, and the intended semantics anyway. Obviously, this is just syntax we're doing now. But it takes the intended idea in the example is that hdiff takes two objects and returns the difference in age between the two of them. So hdiff John, father of John, equals 25, right? So these are definitely supposed to be terms here.
Question?
Yes.
Do you see this being implementable, let's say, in RDF, or more specifically, I mean, in fully implementable in XML?
Can I ask what you mean by it being fully implementable in XML?
Yes, being the SCL language.
Well, SCL is not really a language. SCL is a specification of an entire class of languages.
Right.
And
can
any
implement a full sort of representational framework
in XML.
SCL requirements and
absolutely.
XML.
Absolutely. If you want to develop, it is certainly the intent that there be an XML face to that there be XML manifestations of the SCL language framework, right? There should be SCL conformant XML-ish manifestations of it.
This is Bo Newman. Looking at what you're presenting here, I mean, a very simple thing you can see coming out of this is that there would be an SCL schema for any kind of XML type representational language that you want to do.
Yes, I mean that's right, and you can give. In fact, we actually have on the SCL, which I neglected to give the website. I'll do that, but we actually have an example in one of the SCL documents of a DTD for an XML representation of a first order of a SCL compliant first order language.
Sort of XML, I mean, do you see that fully, can it be fully constructed under the RDF syntax?
I'm not quite sure the question, Peter. Can you elaborate a little bit more?
Can you again? I mean, put this entire framework in RTF.
Well, not if what you mean by putting the framework in RDF. Let me address that a little bit. So one thing that we could mean by that about putting the framework in RDF is right now, as I'm describing the framework to you, I'm using sort of mathematical English, right? I'm using some set theory. Obviously, this app term up here, I'm using the union sign, and I've got a name there for the natural numbers. So I'm presenting the framework to you using English supplemented by some set theory. Now, RDF certainly is vastly underpowered compared to that framework. But this is the framework we use to lay out systems. Even the framework that we use to describe RDF is going to be stronger than RDF. If you look, for example, at Pat Hayes' model theory for RDF, that's using all the resources of standard first-order set theory to describe the language and its semantics. So certainly, the first point is that the meta-language that we're using to describe the SCL framework is certainly far more powerful than standard RDF. It's, in fact, more powerful than first-order logic. I mean, first-order logic by itself, that is to say, because I'm actually using a first-order theory, namely set theory, as a meta-language to describe the framework. Now, it is the case, though, however, that it's certainly possible. I mean, RDF will certainly be RDF could certainly be a let me back off on that a little bit. What we'll have, and I think this is on a later slide, is that there's going to be sort of full conformance to SCL, and that's going to require that your language be at least the power of, you know, a kind of standard first order language. But we also make provision for conformance for languages which are expressively weaker. And, of course, most of the languages that are of any use for automated reasoning on the web are going to be substantially weaker than full first-order languages. RDF is quite a lot weaker. Description languages for description logics are weaker. The reason for this is both pragmatic. In the case of RDF, I mean, you might start off just by thinking, well, look, what's the most basic sort of pieces of information that we need to be able to at least get a useful amount of information expressed that we can schlep around from site, from place to place on the web? But there's a kind of deeper theoretical reason as well, and that's that that implication, whether one thing follows from another in a full first-order language is in fact intractable. In fact, it's not even fully decidable. So we need frameworks which are weaker than first-order logic if we hope to do some reasoning with our information. And in fact, this is sort of one of the central motivations behind description logics, to try and find sort of what's the most expressive languages that we can have which still fall within the bounds of tractability, computationally speaking.
Thank you. Sorry for the diversion.
So, Chris, isn't the summary answer to Peter's question, though, really no? I mean, RDF is only able to express a tiny subset of what SCL has.
It is, to one way of understanding his question. I was worried about the form of what might have been heard in his question is whether sort of RDF can be seen as in any way falling itself counting as an instance of an SCL language. And the answer to that is most assuredly yes.
Understood.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Okay, any further questions about this page? Okay, I'm going to go to the next page, SCL grammar : predicables. So the previous page gave us the grammar for terms in general, just in terms of structure. I'm going to move to the next page real quick here just because I want to see where I am. Okay, good. Okay, I'm going back now to, no, I'm not. I lied. I have a one-button mouse for my iMac, so I have to hit the right, I have to push down a key to get a, to simulate a right-click. All right, so we're going to do exactly the same thing for formulas of the language in general, or sentences of the language. We'll do exactly what we did for terms. We're going to define the basic sentences, or so-called atomic sentences of the language, purely in terms of structure. So to prepare the groundwork for that, we need this notion of a predicable. So an in-place predicable is anything that can be predicated of n arguments. In a standard first-order language, the only notion of predicable around is an n-place predicate, right? You just, right at the outset, you define your class of n-place predicates, right? So you have terms like loves and kicks and is a dog and so on and so forth, and these are your predicables. But because SCL permits but doesn't require these sort of these higher order constructs and also has type free constructs, what can count as a predicable is rather broader than just simply the class of predicates. In fact, as we noted at one far end of the lexical spectrum there, we've got no distinction between individual and predicate constants at all. So we have to be a little bit more careful about defining the general class of predicables. So in general, it's going to include the class of n-place and variably polyadic predicate constants, and possibly also general variables, as it turns out. And that class of predicate constants might include some so-called, so to speak, individual constants as well, for those cases where, as in the next example there, we want to be able to actually predicate properties of relations or predicables, the things referred to by predicables themselves. So we see here KIF-like representation of an axiom for the symmetry, the property of symmetry. So we say that F is symmetric just in case if X bears F to Y, then Y bears F to X. And we've just expressed it in a standard first order kind of Principia Logica style syntax below that. Okay, so that's the notion of a predicable. I'm moving to the next page, atomic formulas. So now we're just simply defining, we're going to put the same kind of requirement on the construction of atomic formulas that we had for the construction of terms. So once again, we're not going to specify what, you know, how you form atomic predicates. We're not going to say, well, you know, do it this way. You use, you know, prefix notation, or you use infix, or you use, you know, angle brackets, parentheses, whatever. That's all completely up to you and however you like to build your languages. All we say is, given the n-place predicables, which recall can include variably polyadic because they can take any number of arguments, we specify only then the structure of atomic formulas, so a predication operator. So we just simply say, look, for your language to be SCL conformant, what you need is a predication operator, and it has to work like this. Okay, we'll call it holds, but this is just saying you need some way of systematically forming atomic formulas that take an n-place predicable and n terms, and the result of that will be what we call an atomic sentence or an atomic formula. So again, it does not specify at all what the shape of your language is. It just simply puts a general constraint on it. So let me move to the next slide.
Can I ask a question at this point?
Of course.
One might want to say, or often will want to say, that something holds in a particular context. And according to the specification, holds looks like it's a unary predicate, basically.
This is perhaps a bad choice of terminology on our part. Holds is a completely syntactic function.
Okay.
It might have been better to call it make atomic. In fact, holds is a very bad choice, because you're right. I mean, the holds is often used as a very important predicate, which is saying of a sentence that it's true or not.
So you might have a predicable saying holds in context, then you have a frame
exactly.
in a context. And then
exactly.
Surrounding that, you have an envelope which includes holds.
Well, holds, the word holds now should, you know, in general, we're talking at the meta linguistic level now, and we're just simply saying there has to be some kind of an operator, and I called it very poorly holds. I really should have called it, like I said, make atomic.
Okay.
it's a metalinguistic requirement saying you've got to have something in the specification of your grammar which forms atomic statements out of end place predicables and end terms. So holds, the word, what I'm calling holds here and should have called make atomic, is just simply whatever syntactic function you choose, which yields atomic sentences from an end-place predicable and end terms.
So a predicate called holds in context could serve the function of this holds.
Holds in context would be an instance of the pred n there, pred sub n.
Right.
That would be an example of a predicable in your language that
right.
you would be using to form atomic predicates.
Okay.
To form atomic sentences.
Okay. Well, that partially
yeah.
clarified.
I apologize. It's bad terminology. It's
okay.
really a terrible choice of terminology.
Okay.
And your question, I'm going to rush to change that. It really is a bad choice because usually holds is a very loaded predicate in a lot of contexts. It's often used as a very important sort of semantic predicate, especially in representation languages that have contexts floating around. Where, as you say, you want to say, you know, holds this holds in this context, that holds in that context. This is not at all the way this predicate is working. So again, think of holds as rename it in your minds to something like make atomic. And it's a metalinguistic predicate. In general, a given language will never have an actual string anywhere that says make atomic, right? What we're saying in our specification is you just simply have to have a way of forming atomic sentences out of predicables and terms. That's all it is. That's all we're saying here.
Okay.
And it's just kind of done in a kind of maybe excessively formal sort of way, which I have a tendency to do.
Chris, is this the same as what used to be the tick in Old KIF?
No. Because, again, that was part of the language. This is just simply, we're operating in the meta language now. We're in a framework where we're telling you what languages sort of, what the general structural features of an SCL conformant language have got to be. So, the tick was actually an actual feature of KIF. That was an actual part of the language with a specific semantics. The holds here or make atomic here is just the general name that we're giving in our framework here for it's picking out a certain requirement that has to be present in your grammar. So basically, what it's telling you is if you want an SCL language, then you have to make you have to have a class of things called end place predicables, and you have to make atomic sentences out of those things and an appropriate number of terms. That's all it's saying. So it's just a general constraint on the construction of SCL conformant languages. Okay.
I'm not sure I still get it, but we should probably move on.
Okay. All right. Let me try one last time. So remember, if you write logic in an RDF sort of way, right, where you're going to have something like, you know, a sentence in angle brackets, and then, you know, predicate in angle brackets, and then the word loves, and then angle brackets name John, and then close angle brackets, and angle brackets name Mary, and then you close all of those tags, right? Your version of what I'm calling holds here, or the make atomic function, would be something like this. Write down the word sentence in angle brackets, then write down the word predicate in angle brackets, then write down one of the strings of your language that counts as a predicate or a predicable. Then write down the word name in angle brackets, and then write down one of the strings in your language, and then write down angle brackets slash name, right? And then write name again in angle brackets and a string from your language, and then slash name, and then close off all of those tags, right? That would be a manifestation of this make atomic or holds operator. It's just whatever it is, whatever rule it is, think of it as a rule for constructing, a syntactic rule for constructing, for actually constructing well-formed expressions in your language. It's just simply whatever rule it is that you've adopted that gives you what you call atomic sentences, whatever form those happen to take, whether you're using a KIF-like language or an XML-ish type language.
Oh, great. Okay, so and you said all these things, but it just got me. So let me try to summarize, if I may.
Good.
So this is a purely syntactic operator. It's not
metalinguistic. Yeah.
Not appears, something that appears in the object line.
Correct.
It's a device that you would essentially use in the spec for SCL.
Exactly.
Stand-in for the particular syntactic forming operators that one would employ in a manifestation of SCL.
Precisely right.
ISP language or an XML-like language.
Exactly right.
Thank you.
Exactly right. Okay. So next page. So formulas now. So again, we're just simply specifying the structure. I'm on this one that says SCL grammar colon formulas 1. We specify only the structure of complex formulas. So complex, we just simply mean the, you know, when you build up sentences with Boolean operators like and or and not, and quantifiers for all and some as their manifestations in KIF, or an upside down A and a backwards E is their manifestation in a standard first order language. But all we do at the SCL level is say, look, you got to have you got to have some operators now. Now this is metalinguistic. They don't have to look like this. It's just simply requiring that there have to be rules in your syntax by which you use to form identities, negations, conjunctions, disjunctions, conditionals, existential quantifications, and universal quantifications. However they happen to look, whether you use, you know, again, a wedge or the word and or whatever. Okay, the operations are one-to-one, and their ranges are pairwise disjoint. That's just because, you know, you don't want negations and conjunctions to look exactly the same. So we call these collectively, we call them formula generators, because they're going to be recursive in nature. You stick some stuff in, and it gives you another formula or another sentence, and then that sentence can itself be an argument to these operators to build more complex ones in the usual sort of way for building up any kind of formal language, whether it's a programming language or a first-order language. You look at the BNF for C, and you'll find something analogous to these. Okay, I'm going to move to the next slide. SCL grammar formulas, or maybe sentences would be better, too. And once again, see, we're just simply specifying structure. So the id operator takes two terms and yields a formula. And that might be of the form, in a KIF-like setting, that would be open paren, identity sign, space, and then a term, another space, and another term, close paren. In a first-order language, it might just simply be, you know, term, and then the equal sign, and then another term. In an RDF-type language, it might be, you know, angle brackets identity, and then angle brackets term, and then a string from the language, and then slash term, and so on and so forth, right? So again, whatever the form your identity statements take, they just simply have to take two objects and yield an identity formula as output. Similarly, a negation takes a formula or a sentence and returns a formula. Conjunction takes, in the SCL spec, takes an arbitrary number of formula, a finite number of formulas, and returns a given formula. Conditional takes two formulas and returns a formula. If A, then B. Existential quantifier, that all of that rigmarole there is basically just simply saying you got some the middle spec there, the GVAR cross PCON union, PCON 1 union PCON omega, don't worry about that. That's just simply to allow for restricted quantification. So ignoring that and just looking at the GVAR, when you do an existential quantification, you bind a variable, and the GVAR there is indicating the binding of the variable. So it takes a formula and a variable, which it binds and yields a formula as output. So notice again, no specification whatsoever of the particular form that your language has to take. We're just specifying it at the level of abstract syntax. Okay, I'm going to move to the next slide unless there's a question. All right, concrete instances. So now we can see very clearly now that there's this abstract structure here at the top there, which is just simply using all of those operators that we just introduced all the way down to the holds, or much better, make atomic, or just plain old atomic, maybe, so that we don't confuse it with, as it's very easy to do here, confuse it with the usual kind of high-powered semantic operator that we use in a lot of representation languages. Okay, so that structure there has three very, very different looking concrete instances, all of which are universal quantifications of a conditional whose arguments is itself an existential quantification and a conjunction. And the conjunction, of course, has two atomic sentences as its arguments. So it's saying basically every boy kissed a girl. Right. For every X, if X is a boy, then there's some Y, such that Y is a girl, and X kissed Y. The top one is a KIF representation. The second one is a standard Russell Whitehead upside-down A, backwards E sort of first-order logic. And the last one is John Soa's CGIF. It's also a nice way to write logic at a keyboard. Okay, so notice, again, the important thing is here that all of these are conformant, all of these conform to the structure specified by an SCL language, but they have very, very different representations. So John Soa doesn't have to stop writing logic in CGIF to be considered to be using an SCL conformant language, and Adam doesn't have to stop using KIF. Those languages can both be considered essentially the same thing, right? They're both doing logic and they're doing it in the same way, in a conformant way, but in the frameworks that they're familiar with and want to continue using. Okay, I just changed to the next page. Interpretations. Okay, this I think is perhaps not as I think that. Let me just look quickly here. The point of this section, the next couple of slides, is just that there's a nice flexible semantics that covers the entire lexical spectrum that we talked about, from the standard sort of highly constrained first order languages where every predicate has a definite arity and there's no overlap between predicates and constants and has no sequence variables, no type freedom of any sort, everything's highly typed, to the completely free sequence variable laden language of dependence KIF. Those are all covered by the notion of SCL, by the framework that is described by SCL. They're all considered SCL conformant languages because they all satisfy the general structures that are specified in SCL. And what we're saying here is that we're able to give a general semantics that fits all of them. So we just one simple specification, and just whatever niche you fall into in the lexical spectrum, the model theory will just sort of apply itself to you in a very straightforward way. In the semantics, we've got individuals and we have relations. Without specifying what the exact relation between those two are, whether they're disjoint, as would be the case in a standard first-order model, or whether there's some overlap. And there's we assign extensions to the relations in the same sort of way that in a way similar to what happens in a first order language. So we notice, I'm going to move back to that previous page now, the interpretations page. So we notice something that's a bit different here, about this framework is it does, it does reify relations. It has a domain R of relations and intention. They needn't be relations and intention. They could be extensional relations. But we do reify relations, and this turns out to be a very flexible, very convenient thing to do. For one thing, it's a very natural thing to have when you're in a framework where predicate relations of things, but you can also predicate things of relations, for example, the subclass relation or something like that. But extensions are assigned to relations in the usual sort of way. Denotation function is standard. Truth looks pretty much the same exactly. Notice we specify it just in terms of the general specification for what an atomic statement has got to look like. Now, we use this holds predicate again, and I'm just cringing every time I say it now since it's been made so evident that it was a bad choice. Again, this is our syntactic operator, which is just simply saying, so what we're saying here is we're giving the clause for whatever shape your atomic sentences look or have, whatever your atomic sentences happen to look like, here's how you assign them a truth value. So what's going to go in here is pick whatever rule you've got for forming atomic sentences. Take one of those atomic sentences and put it in here. This specification now will apply, whether you use an XMLish syntax, whether you use a KIFish syntax, whatever. That's what's going in it. But notice we're just specifying it at the level of abstract structure so that we're able to give a general semantics. One nice thing then about the semantics is it does permit us to have, does give us an interpretation for those languages that would choose to be type-free and allow predicates to be predicated of themselves. It gives us there's no problem with paradox or anything like that. So that's the sub-bullet of the second bullet point there. But the semantics, we don't have to change the semantic specification at all. It works for whether you allow for that kind of type freedom or not. SEL can be, SEL, let's just look at the first bullet point. In its current form, leaves the logical properties of standard first-order languages sentences completely intact. Sentences that were logically true in standard first-order logic remain logically true in SCL. All the inference relations, everything remains exactly the same. Logical properties can change a little bit in interesting ways. This is an interesting theoretical point that Ian Horrocks identified and that we that I won't talk about today for out of interest of time. There's a very straightforward translation of SCL languages without sequence variables into a standard sort of first-order language. And that really just comes by now introducing and making my original choice doubly terrible. The holds predicate here is actually meant to be an actual object language predicate, the hold sub n and app sub n. And you can now you can eliminate type freedom now by actually just turning everything, all the predicates and all the constants, all the individual constants, make them all individual constants, and then just introduce a class of holds predicates and a class of app predicates. And what you get is very easy to prove. What you get is a completely standard sort of first-order language. Okay, that's it. Questions people might have or more general discussions that might or issues that might sort of spin off of this, I'd be real happy to talk about.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Yep.
Very well organized presentation. If people who are still on the wiki page, if you scroll down, there's a section about the question for the presenter. Right above that, there's a section called links to additional relevant resources, and actually if you could maybe post a few links to maybe published papers.
I will, yeah, there's some
on SCL that would really be appreciated.
Yeah, there is just I'll I'll certainly put the link there, but just very quickly, there's a page here actually on this machine that I'm looking at a site called CL for Common Logic. That's what SCL sort of came out of. SCL is a sort of just slightly cut down version. CL.TAMU.edu. So TAMU, like Texas A&M University.
All right.
And right, that's just an alias for my desktop machine. Running a web server.
Okay, so I'm pasting that over there. If you think of other things to point us to, please, by all means.
I will, absolutely.
If everybody refresh their page now, that link has been posted.
Oh, good, thank you.
Right. I had a few questions along the way.
Yep.
Maybe you can field those.
Oh, I actually do see up above in my little bio there, I actually did include that link, but at any rate, that's good. It's good to highlight that.
So the question actually for both Chris and Adam piece, how close is the flavor of TIFF used in Sumo to being SCL conformant?
So I've never looked exactly in detail at that, but I'm pretty fully confident that it would be very easy to show that it's completely conformant.
Yeah, there are only two things that jumped to my mind. So one is really easy, that I remember we had discussion about whether and or allowed for empty argument set.
Right.
What was the conclusion on that?
To allow them.
To allow them to be empty.
Yes.
Yeah. So that.
But of course, but again, it allows it. There would be a way of specifying. There would be a way of specifying it to. I mean, the worst that would happen is that this would be what's the word that we call it? I think semi-conformant, which I don't think is a good term because it suggests that it doesn't get all the way there somehow. But you could have languages which are slightly weaker in expressiveness, although in this case it wouldn't be a weakness, but that differ slightly. They don't have quite all the full resources of SCL and can still be fully compliant. But I would have to look at exactly how it's being done. Are you saying that you don't allow empty ones in your language, in your version in the Sumo, Adam?
Right, and that shouldn't be a problem because it just means that SCL is broader and Sumo
is
a little narrower. So Sumo KIFF would still be SCL compliant.
That's right.
And the other issue was of the sorted quantifiers.
Yeah. Currently, in the current spec, the sorted quantifiers are fully allowed but not required.
Okay, good. Then SUAKIF's also compliant in that regard.
All right, great.
So maybe, Adam, you can post the answer there now that you've sort of figure out where things stand. So my next question actually is, among those cited as having contributed to SCL, and that's almost like who's who list, which of them are actually doing projects with SCL under what guys?
To which list are you referring?
I mean, your original. You said, I mean, the people who originally contributed.
Oh, all of those folks. I'm not sure there's anybody except for me and Pat sort of working on SCL these days. We've had a bit of a hiatus, and both of us are sort of returning to it at this point. I actually am just finishing a paper for the Dogstuhl workshop that Mike Uschold was part of putting together in Germany a few weeks ago, and I talk a lot about SCL in that, and I'm sort of we're sort of picking up momentum once again to get several things published and to sort of finish up the spec, because Pat has a beautiful paper that he's got in a pretty much a complete state. There's a link to that on the web. It's the one that I call the friendly version rather than the hostile informal version. And really, these just need to be polished up a bit and pushed a little bit more. But both Pat and I, over the last 6 to 9 months, have been really sort of waylaid by other projects and by obligations from people who actually give us money or expect us to do things in return for salary. And so there's been a bit of a loss of momentum there that is kind of picking back up again now that both of us have sort of got ourselves in positions where we've finished other tasks and other priorities.
Sounds great. Is Pat's paper published?
No, but it's available on the web there. Yeah, there's one. We've published one workshop proceedings when we gave. I gave this talk at IS. What is it? It was the one in Florida. It was at Sanibel Island last year, which I guess is now cut in two because of the hurricanes.
I guess of the two, the few things that we are particularly concerned with. I mean, Sumo for one, and of course XML on the other.
Yeah.
Who is working on the XML version of an SCL conformant language under what project or label, and how far along?
Not really developing under a project or label. I mean, Pat and I are still kind of have our feet as well. I have my feet more in the academic world than anything. So for me, it's this is something I ought to be working on, and so I work on it. But there isn't really any kind of official. You can see in the SCL paper, the hostile informal version. There is a DTD for an XML first order XML language, which is SCL compliant. It's really not difficult to do. The DTD is only 15 lines long, something like that. I think the DTD is actually at one point. It's out there with a web address, and you can specify whether something's conformant, and it'll go out and check the DTD and check your XML to see if it complies with the DTD.
Okay, great. Other questions? No. Is Mike Hushel still there?
Mike?
I
guess we lost him.
Unfortunate, because I had a question for him, which is totally unrelated to this talk, but related to the other project that we're working on, so
yep.
Maybe I'll catch him elsewhere. Adam?
Yes.
Okay, you have other questions?
I don't think so. I mean, this is really beautiful, especially now that I actually understand the Holds operator a little better, that we can now, have a formal method for generating these families of languages, and this
yep.
is a great way to really bypass all the religious wars about syntax while
yep.
really sticking to the heart of the matter.
That is exactly the motivation, Adam, and that's exactly what happens. You get people very, very much... Long since converted to their language, and rightly so. Why they shouldn't have to give it up if it's adequate for expressing what they need to express. There's no reason whatsoever that they should have to be doing things some other way just because someone says so. There ought to be a way of making them all equally conformant. Notice this: as far as the integration issue too, there's a strong motivation here to facilitate integration. Once again, the idea would be. What you do instead of writing a translator into the interlingua, as was the original vision there back on the early pages of the presentation with KIF, the idea is you just simply publish your conformance, right? You publish here's my Holds relation, here's my app relation, here's my conj. You basically just publish the specification for your language, and that makes it very simple to see very clearly how your language connects to mine. I could see very, very quickly whether, your language is a sub-language of mine at a structural way. It also gives me a very easy way of converting from your language into mine, right? If you send me a bunch of stuff and I can understand all the stuff you sent me in terms of just its abstract structure, well, I know how to understand my language in terms of its abstract structure as well. So it gives me pretty much, if I've written a translator in terms of that structure, I can immediately incorporate the stuff that you sent me.
Oh, just two other questions I thought of. So one on the language and one on the standard status of the document. So
yeah.
The first one, I don't remember you talking in the talk so far about higher order constructs like having sentences as arguments. Is that allowed?
That's not part of the SCL spec proper. What you could have, though, let me say this. Let me think for just a second so I say this correctly. Certainly, a language that has sentences as terms, where you can form complex, you know, terms out of sentences, could certainly count as an SCL compliant language. But really, what you're talking about is taking a language and building a theory out of that language. So notice, for example, SCL doesn't. SCL would give you a specification for a first order language in which you could write then axioms for set theory, say. Well, in the same sort of way, you can think of a framework, an integration framework for integrating ontologies would really be a theory. You're going to build an appropriate sort of language which will have as its intended semantics different ontologies and their contents. And so you'll introduce predicates which are appropriate for that language, such as, you know, well, you know, the content of this sentence is contained in the content of that sentence, or, you know, these two sentences are logically equivalent, or whatever. But what you'd be building in that case is a theory in a language which is itself SCL conformant. But SCL itself doesn't tell you how to do that. Though, of course, because one of the intended purposes of SCL is to facilitate integration, that is in fact a sort of target project, is to actually develop a framework for integration using SCL. And in fact, that's what this paper that I'm finishing up for the Dogstool seminar is taking some first steps toward.
Okay.
I may not have asked that question specifically enough, though. So, I mean, what I meant was, can you have open paren believes space John space open paren likes space Mary space Bob close paren close paren?
Well, I answered that question, but I didn't answer it specifically enough.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
I know I kept it way too high level. So, yeah, because those are all going to be operators in a specific language. So SCL itself doesn't. There is an SCL conformant language which has those operators in it, but they're not specified. They're not given specifically in the SCL syntax. Does that answer the question?
No. I'm not thinking of these as being operators. I'm thinking of these as being arbitrary predicates in an ontology where the language allows arbitrary predicates to take sentences as arguments.
Yeah.
Actually, a second-order language.
Yeah, I think we're just not kind of connecting here. SCL doesn't tell you how to do that exactly, but a language that enables you to do that will be an SCL conformant language. But you have to introduce the apparatus of quotation and so on and so forth in a specific language whose intended purpose is to enable you to express things like that. Just as you're going to have to introduce, you know, this particular constructs for doing, say, you know, set theory. You know, SCL doesn't tell you what those constructs are exactly. You have to introduce them yourself. But having done so, your language will be SCL conformant. So, I mean, those things will be all be available, but they're not specifically part of anything that we've done in SCL yet. That maybe kind of sort of answers your question.
Yeah, because there's an additional complication for SUO-KIF that there's actually no specific syntax for calling out these second-order operators,
right,
forcing them to be terms,
right,
that you know, SUO-KIF is free in that regard, and it allows the implementation of that, a particular inference system, to either, you know, handle the full higher-order logic if it's capable of it,
right,
or of, because, you know, you can recognize without any extra syntactic device that there is a second-order expression,
yeah,
for my sigma implementation does put essentially a tick before that formula and turn into a term, so
yeah,
that remains first order.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is all getting into the, you know, the use of SCL for actually, you know, building stuff and building frameworks to facilitate integration and to add these sort of metalinguistic constructs to a language. And it would, I think, be smart actually to add a section to SCL that tells you how to build languages of this sort. But it's as yet nothing that's been done.
Yeah, especially since a lot of your presentation has talked about, you know, SCL being essential first-order logic with a couple of escapes, and if you're now allowing, you know, passing sentences as arguments, you're sort of in a dramatically different logical space of allowing higher-order logic. And
I don't think it's that dramatically different. I actually think it would be fairly straightforward to do. And I don't think strictly you're in a higher order logic either, but that's a discussion we can have offline.
Okay, and then if
I may,
other question that I haven't gotten to about the standard status.
Adam?
I'm sorry, Peter, we're talking over.
Because the timing for the call may run out any moment.
Oh yeah, right.
For the sake of the recording, let us all thank Chris for giving us the talk on SCL, which has been extremely wonderful. And this is the Ontolog Forum, November 4th, 2004. Okay, back to you, Adam. I'm sorry. I'm afraid we might abruptly get kicked off the call and we didn't get this into the recording.
Right.
Okay, so now we got the message from the sponsor. So the question was, what's the formal standard status of SCL? I mean, has the new work item been approved? Is this an ISO draft standard or something? Or what's...
Mike Grinninger knows better exactly where...